Hi, this is Tyler Gossawar. Today is December 21st, 2013, and I have a very special guest, my old friend, the good doctor, John Westfall. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hi, Todd. I'm doing pretty good. I will embrace the old adjective as best I can as you give it to me, but I am, I guess I'm a doctor, not that kind of doctor, but I'm a psychologist who currently is splitting his time teaching at a school in Louisiana and also still messing around with all these wonderful mobile devices and this wonderful technology stuff that has been my addiction, my main vice for most of my life.
Yeah, and so I know John from the days when we were both Windows Mobile MVPs. Are you still an MVP? I am not.
No, I got kind of, I guess they cleaned out the old and put in the new.
Exactly. So for those who don't know, Microsoft has a program called the MVP program, Most Valuable Professionals. And John and I were both in that little group. Well, actually got to be a kind of a big group after a while, mm-hmm. but in that group for many years. I was there for, I think, 11 years. I think you were pretty close to that, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years, something.
Yeah, it was 4 or 5 years. Yeah. So it felt longer. I made my presence known big and large once I showed up. So
we've known each other for a while. Because we've been former MVPs for a couple of years now, and John is, as he said, a mobile device fan. Maybe fanatic might be a better word. But so, John, what are you using these days?
Well, these days I'm pretty boring overall. I try to stick in the iOS ecosystem for most of my day, just because things tend to sync a little bit easier, and there's a client for everything on iOS. Every mobile developer targets usually iOS as their first rollout. In fact, it makes a lot of news headlines when people say they're going to target Android or any other platform for their first rollout. So I find that's just easier with the people that I know, such as you, Todd, who use a bunch of different things. If I want to play with those things, I need to have a device that can access all those. So that's why most of the time I'm on iOS. I do have a few Android devices lying around here and an old Windows phone device that I pull out on occasion just to play around with. But most of my day, it's a very boring iPhone 5. And an iPad mini that's my reading and fun device. That's where I've got games and such loaded up. And then a full-size iPad for my lecture notes and such when I'm teaching. I finally ditched the giant notebooks that I used to carry around, giant three-ring binders, actually, that had every slide that I was going to project and notes underneath, and got myself to just use Evernote for most of my lectures.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I'm fairly similar to you. My last Windows phone was the HTC HD7, which was at the time a fairly big screen device. I think it's, I don't know, mm-hmm. 4 inches or 4 point something inches. And it never got upgraded to 7.5, if I recall correctly, or 7.8. I think it went to 7.5, but
yeah,
not 7.8.
It did go to 7.5, because that's the one I've got over here, and I remember pulling out everything to do the 7.5 upgrade, because I think it still had to be done through the Zoom client. So that was after that upgrade. I don't know if I really missed that it didn't get a 7.8 upgrade, because I would have had to pull everything out again just to upgrade the thing.
And then, of course, Microsoft abandoned us, those of us, I should say, who already had devices, when they moved to Windows Phone 8, and I never got one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems very similar to what I ended up doing, just because by that point, looking at the differences between what my HD7 could do and the 8 devices and what I really needed them to do, I figured I could, and I was already kind of transitioning away from that platform, just as I kind of hope that if I transition away, if I come back and this platform is vibrant and happy in 5 years, then I will want a device, obviously, at that point. So the intermediary devices I will stay away from.
Yeah. And as for myself, I use a Nexus 4 for my main voice phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have an iPhone 5. But the reason I don't use the iPhone 5 as a voice phone is it's on AT&T. And my home is a dead zone. AT&T dead zone. My Nexus 4 is on T-Mobile, and T-Mobile works fine where I live. So that's my voice phone.
You know, getting at the pragmatics of what we use as our primary devices. When I moved this last time from New York to Louisiana, I had been on T-Mobile for about 9.5 years. Mm-hmm. And the only place I couldn't get T-Mobile service was my apartment complex, which is a very bad place to not be able to get mobile phone service when you don't have a home phone. So I did some investigating. I found out even though I was on the T-Mobile loyalty plan for people that had stuck around with them for 9 years, I could actually get a cheaper plan. My wife and I had never moved on to a family plan when we got married, and I realized that actually for my needs, Verizon would have been cheaper. So I moved over to Verizon, and of course that then limits my ability to use all of my GSM phones that I had been building up for a number of years. So I do have a Verizon Android device over here. I have a Droid DNA that I occasionally swap my SIM card out of my iPhone 5 into. But I've been a big fan of the Nexus line. I'd had all the Nexuses up to the Nexus Galaxy. And then just after I moved over to Verizon, didn't really end up buying anything new other than just the iPhone.
Yeah, it is funny. They do have a lot of the Verizon Droid brand Android phones, but not much else.
Yeah, and it's interesting how Verizon is kind of pushing themselves this year in their advertising as we are the place to go buy your technology gifts for all of your friends and for, I guess, yourself. Their commercial I saw last night where they're, you know, they have the Beats headphones and the tablets and everything and the Samsung Galaxy smartwatch. They are really pushing that, you know, in the future you won't go to Best Buy or you won't go anywhere else. You will go to Verizon, which is interesting for a mobile phone operator to put themselves in that sort of marketing mindset of, sure, we've got something for everyone.
Yeah, it is kind of surprising. I haven't seen that commercial, and I find it surprising because I assume that, like a lot of other retail outlets, you know, Best Buy and, I don't know, who else, Walmart or some, also sell Verizon phones, so it's they're kind of competing with their own partners at that point.
Yeah, well, that's not uncommon in the tech world, it seems,
yeah.
That you compete with the ones you love to try to get your little share of the world.
Yeah. Continuing on, I guess I should mention that, like John, I'm using the iPad Mini as my primary tablet. I never upgraded past an iPad 2, so I'm now three generations behind in full-size tablets. But I did recently buy two, and this is surprising, I think, to many of my friends. I bought two Windows-based tablets, and it's surprising my friends because they know that after an initial fond honeymoon with the Surface RT last year, I became less than enchanted with Windows RT and kind of railed on all of Windows 8. But I have to say that after 8.1 came out, I decided that I really wanted to take a look again at this platform, and I picked up an Asus T100, which is one of those it's not really transformer, but it's a tablet that comes with a detachable keyboard. It's really nice, about 10 inches large. And I liked it so much, when I saw the Dell Venue 8 Pro at Costco, of all places, recently, I picked it up, and I have to say, although it's heavy, it's really heavy compared to the iPad Mini. As an 8-inch device, it is really nice. The desktop, of course, is a little bit difficult to use because you have to, as Steve Jobs used to say, when people asked him about small tablets, you have to sharpen your finger to just hit those little tiny targets on the screen. But that's only in desktop mode. It's not so bad on Metro, and I'm really becoming quite fond of it. We'll see if this lasts for a while or if I sour on it like I did with Windows RT. But the ability to run real software, if you know what I mean.
desktop is really a win. I think for you and I, we both were in the Windows ecosystem for so long that we have favorite utilities and favorite tools and favorite ways of doing things with Windows. And while products like Windows RT tell us this is, you know, the wave of the future and you can do everything that you used to do on your old Windows 7 and Windows XP and Windows 2000 and all the other operating systems you used, we don't think like that. We think in terms of what we used to use and what we want to use and what we're comfortable using. And yes, maybe there's a tool in the marketplace that I will be able to download and it will do what I want to do. But I have this utility, you know, whatever, that I've used for 20 years, and I know exactly what that is. Yeah. And I want to be able to pull that up. But yeah, these devices like the Asus T100, which is a transformer, it's in their transformer line, which I'm glad they've actually been able to get their product line moving on that. I remember wanting a transformer a few years ago, and they just never showed up in the retail chain. Those are, I think, giving me hope that I will eventually have a Windows tablet that I'll be using on a regular basis, because it will be able to use the old software as well as the newer stuff.
Yeah, and it's really a win. You know, one of the problems I had with the Surface RT running Windows RT is I couldn't run the legacy, if you want to call it that, legacy software that ran on Windows 7 and earlier. And this became a huge headache, especially when I needed to do something really quick. And the only way to do it, the only way I knew how to do it, maybe, was using that piece of software. You know, like R Project for statistics, or, you know, some special editor for, you know, coding that just didn't exist on the Windows RT platform. So moving to this, it's been a real eye-opener for me, coming back to the real Windows, so to speak. And one of the things I'm looking for now is that, unlike the Asus T100, the Venue Pro, Venue 8 Pro, doesn't come with a keyboard. And mm-hmm. one of the things, as you know, when you especially when you switch to desktop, you really need a touchpad. You cannot use that screen to hit those little tiny objects in the legacy apps. And so I'm looking for a decently priced, and by decently priced I mean, say, under $40 or $50, Bluetooth keyboard with a touchpad. And there are a couple of them, but some of them are really tiny ones, you know, meant to be really remote controls. Mm-hmm. Not quite exactly what I wanted, so I need to keep looking.
Yeah, I know. I've looked at the same ones I think you're referring to. They're almost the thumb pad keyboards, and they have a little touch pad on them. I have a little thumb keyboard that I never really used as much as I thought I was going to. That's Bluetooth, but about 3 years ago, I looked at, I think that, well, maybe it wasn't, a little less than 3 years ago, was when Steve Jobs was talking about we should all be going to touchpads, and I had resisted them for a long time, and then I finally just bought a couple of touchpads and put them at my desk and said, well, I still have my mice, but I'll try these. And I've actually gotten myself quite used to and happy with the touchpad experience over a mouse. And you're right, when it comes to an operating system like regular Windows or even Windows on a desktop, you're not going to want to punch and fight with your computer to tap exactly the little point that you need.
Yeah.
You're going to want a touchpad for that.
Yeah, so for the moment, what I'm doing with the Dell Venue 8 Pro is I bought one of those Amazon Basics Bluetooth keyboards. It was about $25, $30, and that works pretty well. In fact, actually works surprisingly well with it, because it doesn't work all that well with my Android devices. And believe it or not, I dug up my old Microsoft Memory Mouse. I don't know if you remember that, but it for some reason came with a USB thumb drive, which I think was also an RF thing. But the big secret about the Microsoft, I don't know if they sell it anymore, but the old Microsoft Memory Mouse, is that there's a little switch by the battery compartment that you can switch from RF to Bluetooth.
Oh.
And although they never advertised it as a Bluetooth mouse, it actually is one.
Hmm.
And that's what I'm using that, but it's not really practical if, you know, you're going to drop into a Starbucks or something. You got to pull out your keyboard, pull out a mouse, pair them both. You know, I really want one thing, so I'm looking for that.
I've got the old Microsoft Wireless Presenter Mouse, which I guess you can still buy. It's the one that's got the presenter buttons on the bottom of it
for PowerPoint.
And that's a Bluetooth mouse. That's a lot smaller. And just a lot more maneuverable at places like Starbucks than, say, an Apple Magic Mouse or something like that. It's so that's what I use. And I have, for my Bluetooth keyboard, I have an Apple Bluetooth keyboard around here somewhere that I never really liked all that much, just because I missed the number pad. And so I couldn't use it as my primary keyboard. But I also have the old Think Outside Bluetooth keyboard.
I still have one as well.
And that seems to work pretty well with all of my modern devices, so I've been using that.
I wouldn't mind using an Apple wireless keyboard, which is Bluetooth, as you mentioned, except my for I guess I left the batteries in too long, and in you know, the Honolulu's heat and humidity, it expanded and exploded a while back. So I now have batteries permanently stuck in there that and the keyboard's
that don't
useless.
Do their intended function.
No. But in any case, that's been my what my current's quest is for a nice, affordable Bluetooth keyboard, not too small, that also has a touchpad. Yeah, I also wanted to mention that the other thing I really like about having a Windows device is that, you know, there are a couple of things coming out now that you do want to test. One of them that just came out this week is from the Microsoft Research side of the house, and it is called Project Sienna, which I have installed but not tried yet. It's kind of a visual programming environment that lets you create Windows 8 applications. It basically produces HTML5 JavaScript apps.
Okay.
So that's one of the things I'm going to hope to take a look at later this week.
Yeah, I haven't really looked into that much. What I'd be interested to see would be if you can produce HTML5, JavaScript-type apps with it, if you could then take those apps that you've built for, I assume, a Windows platform, and then use something like the Cordova project, aka PhoneGap, and port those over to Android or iOS. That would be a very cool thing for Microsoft to get into. It reminds me, there's an app that I have on my iPad that, I forget the exact name, I won't even try to butcher it because I will forget the exact one, but it does kind of the same idea where you can do the programming straight on the iPad and get a little app ready to go, and then it will actually export all the code straight to Xcode so that you can customize it and then actually build an app that could go into the App Store.
Oh, very nice.
And it does debugging in the you can set it up where it runs a little local web server where you can write the code in your browser on your computer and then actually debug it on the device in real time.
Oh, that's interesting. There's something similar from Microsoft called Touch Develop. I haven't played with it recently, but it was a little bit too visual for me. with some really, I won't say weird, but unusual back-end coding that I never really got comfortable with. But it is very interesting, and I'm sure if I actually spent some time versus just grumbling about it, I could do some really nice stuff with it. It does seem a very interesting platform. It's interesting that Microsoft is trying all of these different mobile ones. There's one out of Microsoft Israel, I believe, that could even provision on an Android device somehow.
Kind
of a web app thing. I've got to go look it up, see whatever happened to that. But in any case, yeah, so that's what I'm using these days, a mix of iOS and Microsoft devices, but not Windows Phone. I've kind of given up on that. Although I have to admit, I am curious about that 41 megapixel Nokia Lumia 1020. Mm-hmm. But as we close up, John, before we started the podcast, you mentioned something about the recent Target credit card cyber theft. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Real quick, the app I was just mentioning, if anyone cares about, is Codea, C-O-D-E-A. That's the one that will let you build games and other things on your iOS device. But also, yeah, I was thinking this week, because my background is in psychology and technology, I think a lot about how we view these things together. And obviously this week, Target made kind of news they didn't want to make, where it came out that about 40 million credit card numbers of people who shopped at Target between basically Black Friday and about early December were compromised. This was actually found out by a couple of banks who their cyber risk people, as part of their way of figuring out what's going on, they actually buy credit card numbers through the black market and then realized, all these credit card numbers from our bank, they all have Target in common. And so once that kind of came out, Target had to confirm it. And the really interesting about it is that it wasn't through Target.com, it was through Target in the stores. And so this is something that most people feel more comfortable with when they're actually at a brick and mortar, that they're not going to have such security issues. And it just kind of reminds us that on the back end, all of these things kind of feed to the same place. But it did get me thinking about mobile technology for payment transfer and such, and how in the next few years, in basically the hope to avoid, probably not something like this, but to avoid smaller things where someone's like, you know, looking over your shoulder and getting your credit card numbers, we might start moving to that. So I had a few technologies I thought were kind of interesting that are up and coming on that I could mention.
Sure, please do.
So the first is something that I think I saw you had an ad for somewhere on the Mobile Views site, the coin card, or the coin programmable credit card that you find at onlycoin.com. Have you looked at that much, Todd?
I have not looked at it much. I've heard of it. I know some people got really excited and actually bought it. I think it started as a Kickstarter type project.
Well, they definitely use the Kickstarter model. They didn't use Kickstarter, but they went the model of pay for it now and you will get it next summer.
Yeah.
Once we have all your money, which is fine if I think we're at the point where most people are trustworthy of these things,
right.
Especially if you've got something mentioned in Engadget and Forbes and all these other places.
Yeah, it really got a lot of press.
It's basically, so for those that haven't looked at it, it looks like a credit card. It's the exact size of a credit card, but it's got a very small computer brain inside of it, a chip that can store up to 8 different credit cards on the actual device. And it's got a little button and a little screen that you can cycle through and pick the device or pick the credit card that you want to use. You load these through your mobile device, so it comes with a little reader that will read your credit cards, and then you can store as many credit cards as you want on your device, and then just pick 8 of them to sync up with the coin card. And on the coin, when you select the card that you want, it shows like the last 4 digits of the credit card number, the expiration date, the things that retailers sometimes need to plug into their point-of-sale systems. And once you set it and you give it to, say, the waiter at the restaurant or wherever, and it goes out of your hands, it also locks down so they can't change the credit card number, and then they swipe it just like a regular credit card and it goes through. It can disable itself if it's out of range of your phone for more than a few minutes. So if it becomes a credit card that you leave behind, you don't have to worry about it becoming a credit card that gets swiped 100 times before you get it back. And it's an interesting application of kind of bridging these two worlds. A lot of payment technologies so far have gone the route of just everything will happen on the phone. So you will send an email or you'll send a PayPal or you'll send whatever it is to the retailer, and that's how it'll all happen. And unfortunately, a lot of retailers aren't quite set up for that. So this is kind of bridging that gap and saying, sure, you can still have most of this information on your phone and select exactly what payment type you want, but when your brick and mortar retailer still has a swipe card, they can use this and swipe it and go from there.
I wonder what a retailer, a person working for a retailer would think seeing this very odd looking card. Well, maybe not odd looking, but certainly not the usual credit card, and saying what?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's something that the next one that I was looking at kind of plays off of in their little video. So the other thing that is a Kickstarter that I backed a few months ago is this this product called Loop. And Loop is basically you plug it into the audio port on your phone, and it can scan your cards just the same as the coin reader can. But you pull it up to a payment system device, like you might find at the register at any store that you go to where you normally swipe your card, and it actually sends through a magnetic induction loop. It basically simulates the same signals that the magnetic stripe on your card does when it sends information to the payment gateway.
Huh.
So it has this very strange looking thing where you basically go up and you point your phone with this fob at the credit card reader, you press a button and the credit card reader beeps as if you've just swiped a card through it. And so this company, when they do their Kickstarter video and such, they have a bunch of clerks at stores looking at these things going, wow, that's like magic. You just beamed a credit card number straight into the machine. And that's a Kickstarter that's supposed to be out and be available in January, February. And they've actually built for people who are on an iPhone, they built a case that has it built right in. So your phone literally can look like it's just magically beaming credit card information straight to the reader.
That's kind of interesting because I don't know how that would work in other places, but I know folks in Europe criticized a coin programmable card because they say they've moved on to NFC over there. And we in the U.S. are kind of, you know, primitives. Still swiping cards.
That did, you know, and it was funny right after. So you and I think, saw that the same place. We're on a mailing list together that has that had people talking about that. And I, the next day, I happened to go to my office, and we have a vending machine that will take credit card. And I realized it had the little looks like they look like the Wi-Fi symbol, but it's basically MasterCharge's little. I forget what they call it. Beam your credit card information. So I look at my MasterCard and it's got the little thing on. I'm like, well, maybe I'll try this. And I pushed it up and it beeped and it was like magic. It was the first contactless credit card transaction I had ever engaged in.
Well,
and
you're one up on me.
I know. It was because I was feeling a lot of pressure from our friends outside of the United States who were making fun of us for not doing these things. Yes. So yeah, both of these projects, Coin and Loop, are interesting to me because the goal would be more security. It's not going to help if your merchant has a bunch of security problems, but it does prevent the problem of leaving your credit card behind. And in Coin's case, your credit card just stops working after you're gone for a few minutes. And in Loop's case, your credit card doesn't exist. It's just your phone. So that obviously, I think, makes some people feel a little bit more secure than just having an old credit card that once you leave it behind, someone could swipe it and use it forever and read the numbers straight off it. With the Coin, you only see the last four digits, so you can't even have someone just spying on your credit card number with that.
Yeah, you know, in fact, as you mentioned, two thoughts come to mind. One, as a young adult, and I didn't get a credit card until I was a young adult, literally. Unlike kids nowadays getting when they're quite young. But as a young adult, I got my first credit card, and I remember handing it over at a restaurant for the first time thinking, no, wait a minute. I don't know you. I'm giving you my credit card. I'm not sure what happens to it after you leave my site and then you return it. How does exactly does that secure? You know?
Well, and the thing that amuses me, it amuses me because people are so adamant about it, especially when you talk to people who are in the older generation, they'll say something like, I don't trust this internet thing of putting my credit card number out there. And yet at the same point, they will do exactly what you just said. They'll give their credit card to an actual human who might have a motive to steal it. The computer doesn't typically have a motive to steal your credit card information. The companies that build these sites, they don't want your credit card information going anywhere other than to them. So it is interesting how we will trust another human with that, but we won't trust a website in some cases.
And the second thought I had was, you know, I think Discover and maybe a few other credit card companies have these one-time credit card numbers you can use. I've never been sure how they work without running out. But it'd be interesting if we had a programmable card that could vend out these one-time credit card number, so we know you use that number one time, and it's gone. If somebody tries to use it again, too bad, it's not going to work, or you know something else will happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. You bring that up, and I remember seeing those, and they made quite a splash when they first came out 4 or 5 years ago, where everyone was advocating them and saying, if you are concerned about security, definitely get these one-time numbers. And I assume they don't run out because you figure with your standard credit card, the first four digits identify the type of card, and I think the second four identify the bank or issuer. Right. So they have quite a large number of possible combos. And as soon as you use it, in their system, it gets unhooked from your account, and they can use it immediately with someone else. Or I guess they probably wouldn't do it immediately. That would be kind of bad. But, you know, give it about 6 months and then cycle it back in. But, yeah, those kind of have gone away.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it?
It would be, I would think that would be a big ticket item, especially for things like these, you know, like the Coin is a programmable credit card. You would think that you could have a very small chip inside of a regular credit card, just like an RSA secure ID token, that would know the algorithm and could generate the next credit card number as soon as the first one had been used and kind of reprogram the stripe. And I would assume that would cost maybe a little bit more, and maybe you'd have to pay $10 or something to get that credit card from your issuer. But for people who are security conscious, that would be a pretty cool thing to have. Although I guess it would really be bad if you end up at one of those retailers that's still stuck 20 years ago with a knuckle buster that, you know, they bring out occasionally and try to take an imprint of your card.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it would be an interest, especially if you travel internationally. And you know, when there are certain countries you travel to, they tell you, you know, put everything that emits anything in a tin foil or lead encased whatever, right? And
yes.
And then using a credit card in those countries, you'd say, But fortunately, I don't travel to those countries, so it's not a huge problem for me. But you know, I've been to a couple of places in my youth that I wondered, should I really use a credit card in this country?
Well, in some cases, you're doing better using a credit card than using cash.
Yeah.
You know? At least you're not flashing how much money you actually have.
Absolutely
on you.
Right. Absolutely right. Yeah.
But yeah, international travel is getting more and more interesting. I was in Canada a few months ago, and I was amazed that all the other people I knew from the United States didn't get any kind of Canadian currency to come up to Canada. They just figured, well, I have my credit cards, and I have U.S. currency, and these people will be happy to take that. And while most of them might, it amused me that we've gotten to the point where with some countries we just kind of assume, I don't need the local currency. I've got plastic.
And actually, if you use a credit card, although I think there's still some kind of fee when you use it outside of your home country, someone once told me, I don't know if this is true, I'm not an expert in travel, but someone once told me you get a better exchange rate, or at least a more up-to-date exchange rate, assuming it's in your favor.
That would make sense. I know when I looked into it, if anyone who's listening to this is traveling to Canada, the three credit cards I use are American Express and then a Chase MasterCard and a Discover card. And the Chase MasterCard and the American Express were charging 1.5% transaction fee, and the Discover card was charging nothing.
Interesting.
It's interesting how Discover has not really taken a big hold in Canada over the last 10 years. They've made significant gains, but they're still the underdog. So they are waiving those transaction fees to make themselves more appealing.
I know outside, I don't remember if I tried Discover card in Canada, but I know outside of the U.S., Discover is not accepted anywhere.
Yes. is true.
Outside of North America, I guess I should say now.
I mean, it's only been in the last really 20 years that Discover card has been accepted widely in the U.S.
So there are still places here that don't take it. That's true.
Yes, there's a Family Guy episode that points fun at that, where they joke about, you know, Discover card being, every year in an exclusive club of just you, you know. Thankfully, it's gotten a little bit bigger.
And on that humorous note, I will bring this podcast. Let me see which one it is. I forgot which number it is. Podcast, Mobile Views podcast number 69. I should also apologize to people who actually listen to these podcasts that I misspoke on my last one and said it was Mobile Views podcast 67. It was 68. Some of us did not major in math, and we can't count very well. But in any case,
that's a good way to hide that there was a secret episode that nobody knew about.
Well, actually, what happened is that, you know, I also do a podcast with some of my friends called Comics Views, and one day, for whatever reason, we combined it. We had a Comics Views and a Mobile Views podcast all in one, and so it had two numbers, and I forgot about that one. But in any case, this is Mobile Views podcast 69. Last one was 68, despite what I said on it. My good friend John Westfall was here with me. Maybe we'll do a couple more every now and then. But thanks for listening, folks, and we'll talk to you next time.